How could it have come to that? How could it have come to that? Joseph's own brothers, all of them together, they had laid violent hands on him, beaten him, and stripped him of his clothing, and thrown him into a deep pit out in the wilderness. And all over what? Over dreams? Over jealousy? Even as Joseph was crying out for mercy from inside of the pit to his brothers, they sat down to eat. There beside the pit, they were going to enjoy a meal together before they would leave Joseph there alone in the wilderness. But then while they were eating, it chanced that some slave traders headed to Egypt came by. Now, Joseph's brothers did want to be rid of Joseph and his idiotic dreams about how they would be bowing down before him. They wanted to be rid of him, true. But no need to kill him. Why not make some money on the deal? Here were these traders. Why not sell him to them? So the 11 sons of Israel sold the 12th as a slave for 20 pieces of silver. And just like that, in one fell stroke, the favorite son of Israel became a slave in the land of Egypt. Now, the brothers, they had intended for this to be an ending to Joseph's story. But nothing could have been further from the truth. Because although Joseph's connection to his homeland and his family seems to have been irrevocably severed, his connection to the spiritual realm, his connection to the realm of dreams, that seemed to be ever stronger. Joseph, somehow, he was able to see the future in people's dreams. Whether a dream portended weal or woe, good fortune or bad, that didn't matter. But Joseph was never wrong. No matter how unlikely his prediction seemed at the time, everything that he said came true. Everything. So famous were the abilities of this soothsaying slave that word of his abilities traveled all the way to the Pharaoh. And so the Pharaoh decided to bring this man to court, to ask him about what the future might hold for Egypt, to understand how best to govern the nation in light of future events. So uncanny, so impressive was this young man that the Pharaoh decided, well, I should simply hand over the governance of the nation to him. He gives him authority to do whatever he pleases. Second only to Pharaoh in power. What could be the harm? Everything that Joseph set his hands to succeeded spectacularly well. Why not simply allow him to do as he pleased? And that's exactly what Pharaoh did. Giving him full power and authority, full use of the riches of the greatest empire in the world. And the first thing that Joseph does with his newfound power, with all the power in the world, the first thing he does is to buy grain. And not just a little bit of grain either. Joseph starts buying all the grain that he could lay his hands on. It seemed an odd thing to do because times were good. Times were better than good. They were great. Better than anybody had ever remembered, actually. Everybody in Egypt had more grain than they knew what to do with. And here comes Joseph, and he's buying? Not only buying, he was building storehouses, warehouses all over Egypt. A network so massive that Joseph stopped even bothering to measure how much grain he had. It was literally immeasurable, except to say that he had enough grain to feed whole nations for years and years and years. But then everything changed. Come harvest time, the crop failed. People couldn't harvest the food that they needed. But times had been good. They had reserves. 1 year became three, became 5 years with no harvest. And the people They had run through their reserves. They had nothing. They had scraped the bottom of every barrel. They had eaten their way to the rear of every cupboard. The food was gone. The nation was starving. There was famine in the land. And not just in Egypt, either. The famine stretched far to the east, all the way to the desert, out to Joseph's homeland, out to his hometown in Canaan. No one had enough food. A famine had a death grip on the land. And all of a sudden, Joseph was sitting on a stockpile of the only thing that had any value anymore. He had grain. Grain enough to feed whole nations for years. And Joseph was selling. So the word went out. Word like that can't help but get out. The Pharaoh's right-hand man was selling grain, and the whole world was buying. The roads into Egypt were jammed with people from all over trying to buy food just to be able to survive, including Joseph's brothers. They traveled to Egypt. They went to go buy food so they wouldn't starve, to feed their families. And there in Egypt, they stood before a man they didn't recognize, in golden robes, in a lavishly decorated audience hall, and they bowed down low. They bowed down low before Pharaoh's right-hand man, down before Joseph, down before the brother they had sold into slavery, bowing before him, just as Joseph's dream had predicted. He was never wrong. Prostrate before Joseph were the brothers who had sold him as a slave for 20 pieces of silver, and they dared to bring silver coins to him to buy their lives back. But Joseph, ever surprising, Joseph forgives them. He forgives them completely. So merciful is Joseph, actually, that he invites his brothers to come and move to Egypt, to bring their whole families. He gives each one of his brothers land. He gives them land in the best parts of Egypt, actually, in the Nile River Delta, in Goshen. He gives them some of the best land in the world, and he gives them food from his own storehouses, free of charge, as much as they need for their entire families until they could ride out the famine. And then once the famine was done, they were sitting on the best farmland in the world. Joseph saw to it personally that the 12 sons of Israel would thrive in the land of Egypt. And thrive they did. They all became prosperous. They had many children. They lived out the rest of their lives in peace. And when Joseph died, he died an old man, full of years. He was gathered into the arms of his ancestor Abraham, he and all of those in his generation. They went the way of all flesh. And generations passed. And centuries flowed by like the Nile, and the descendants of Israel, they became so numerous over the centuries that they became like a nation all to themselves. Hundreds of thousands, millions of the people of Israel now lived in Egypt. They prospered in Egypt. But then everything changed. The good times came to an end. A new Pharaoh came to power. And this new Pharaoh said to himself, Joseph. I don't know anybody named Joseph, but what I do know is that these foreigners, these Israelites, they are living high on the hog. They're raking it in, and we Egyptians, we're just getting by. Whose empire is this? Anyway. So, Pharaoh decides that he's going to put an end to the story of the people of Israel. Pharaoh seized all of their land, and he stole all of their property, and he forced the people of Israel into slavery, them and their children, forcing them into hard labor, forcing them to build warehouses to store grain. Supply city of Ramesses. In one fell stroke, The people of Israel went from being prosperous to being slaves in the land of Egypt. That's the story of how the people of Israel came to be slaves in Egypt. It's because of Joseph. Or rather, it was because of Joseph's brothers and what they did to him. It was because of Joseph's brothers selling him into slavery. If they had never sold Joseph as a slave, then the descendants of Israel would never have been slaves in Egypt. They never would have lived in Egypt at all. The day, the very day, that the sons of Israel sold Joseph into slavery in Egypt, they set in motion a course of events that would lead to the whole people of Israel becoming slaves in the land of Egypt. Selling one man into slavery inexorably led to a whole nation becoming enslaved. Now, this wild tale about a multicolored coat and a man who can see the future in dreams, this story is one of the most sobering tales in the Bible. Because it has something true to teach us about human nature. It has something true to teach us about the nature of human evil, the kind of power that it has, the manner of power that it holds. You see, human evil, we learn, is a living thing. It's a breeding thing. It's almost like a law of nature that evil creates more of itself. That's in fact all that evil is capable of doing, replicating itself over and over. Evil begets evil. It's true of poverty. Indifference to the needs of the poor, hostility to the needs of the poor, these things will not reduce the number of impoverished people. No, in fact, ignoring the cries of the poor will only lead to more people being swallowed up into the deep pit of poverty, because although it is easy to fall into the pit of poverty, it is hard to climb back out again without help. And the more people that are swallowed into that pit, the fewer that there are standing outside and the less they feel they share in common. That is how poverty builds up. It's like congestion in the heart. It's a congestion of the human heart when we accept as a fact of life that some children will be born into destitution. Evil begets evil. It's true about war. The only thing that a war is capable of creating is the next war. War whispers promises it has no intention of keeping. It whispers promises of endless safety to the victors and of vengeance for the vanquished. You see, that's where war lays its eggs. It lays its eggs in the children, in the spiritual wounds that war inevitably inflicts upon both victor and vanquished. You can't use war to create peace any more than you can use a gun to prune an orchard. That's not what it's for. This is the truth that we see revealed in the story of how Joseph being sold into slavery led to the enslavement of all of Israel. The power of evil to recreate itself. Now, Pharaoh had intended to put an end to the story of the people of Israel. He had intended that enslaving these people would put an end to them. But nothing could have been further from the truth. That was not an ending, but rather just a beginning. Because although we learn that evil is a power that is alive in the world, in the story of the people of Israel, we learn that evil is not the only power that is alive in the world. There is another power. The God of Israel is also living. And the God of Israel is a liberator. God sets Israel free from their slavery and breaks the chains of bondage that constrain human destiny to the mere recreation of past evils. God is a liberator because God liberates people from the misery whose roots are sunk in our own history of wrongdoing. That is what God is capable of liberating us from. You see, God is a liberator because God refuses to leave humanity alone to be the ultimate arbiter of our own destiny. Indeed, we are not the ultimate arbiter of our destiny. Rather, that God is God and we are not. God is a liberator because God refuses to leave humanity alone to face the fate that we have created for ourselves with no help at all. You see, God leads people away from the slaveries of their own creation and calls us into new futures, new destinies to live according to God's ways rather than our own ways. And when people are liberated, God calls them to go to places they would never have imagined, to do things they could not imagine themselves capable of. God calls Moses to stand up to Pharaoh, and then Moses finds himself walking through the Red Sea at the head of a nation of people. God calls Ruth to expand the reach of God's people beyond one tribe or nation, and it leads Ruth to live in a new land and to discover that it is love that binds a heart to God. God called Harvey Milk to show that open and proud gay leadership is necessary for a thriving city. And God called Samuel Sewell. God called Samuel Sewell to show the power of repentance, changing him from a person who executed women as witches to someone who was a champion of the dignity of all persons. God led Samuel Sewell to publish the first anti-slavery tract published on this soil, called The Selling of Joseph. God called Dorothy Day to live her life, showing that the poor live at the very heart of God's kingdom. God called Stokely Carmichael to stand against the racism of Jim Crow America, proving that even when a man is unjustly put in prison, he is free every moment that he does what is right. God called Lois Gundon to travel from her home in Indiana to France, to be a French teacher at a Mennonite school in the south of France in 1941. There, she encountered the horrors of the Holocaust and, what's more, the moral terror of those who did nothing in the face of bloodshed. God led her to become an outlaw, to become a smuggler of children, a Yad Vashem, one of the righteous among the nations. You see, evil creates evil, that's true. But God hears the cries of her children and will not allow humanity to be held captive by the evils of our own creation. God will liberate us from our own bondage to give us a new life according to God's ways. God's voice calls, even today, even now, even in this place, God is calling each of us to be free from the things that hold us in chains. Whatever binds you, whatever evil holds you in bondage or which haunts your thoughts as you see it walking unchecked through the world, whatever evil haunts you, know that God is calling you. God is calling you to walk without fear into a new future, a new destiny, to live according to God's ways. God is calling. And if you follow, you will never believe what will become of you.